last furlong. It's 100 yards and never say that skating it, but Ferrier moving up fast. Arabian Knight third, and at the post it is Never Say Die from Arabian Knight, Ferrier, and then Elopement, and then all the rest of them moving in there. Narrator, I think, was next. Last of all was Ruin Zori.
That's the then 18-year-old Lester Piggott winning the 1954 Derby by a clear 2 lengths on the 33-1 shot Never Say Die. One lucky punter who backed him that day was my mother Mona Best, and this is the story of the club that her winnings made possible. I'm Pete Best, and you're listening to the Casbah Club, the birthplace of Merseybet. In the early 1950s, Mona was tipped off by my younger brother Rory that there was a large Victorian family home up for sale in the Hayman's Green district of West Derby, Liverpool. Having grown up in colonial India, Mona was tempted by a house that was set back from the main road and offered not just 15 bedrooms, but around an acre of surrounding land and plentiful storage space in its cellars. Unbeknownst to the rest of the family, she pawned her jewellery and laid off a bet on the American-born Never Say Die, which prior to winning the Derby had won only one of its previous 9 races. Perhaps she just liked the name. With her winnings, Mona was able to place a 50% deposit on what became our family home at 8 Hayman's Green. Family friend and original Casbah Club member Bernie Grindley remembers the evening that Mona announced their intentions to open a basement club following a television documentary about the Two Eyes Coffee Bar in Soho.
The night very, very clearly, it's never left me. We were in the house Saturday night, one of the pop programs was on, whichever one it was, and because I used to spend all my time there because we didn't have a telly in our house, you know, so I watched all my television down there. And she stood up at the end of the show and she said, I'm going to get all the cellars cleaned out. I'm going to open it up as a coffee bar. She said, and I can see all the young men in the area saying to their ladies, come with me to the Casbah. She named it there and then. She'd never spoke to any of her family about this. She uttered this there and then that night. That was a Saturday, I think on the Monday-ish. We may have been on school holidays, I'm not sure. She had me and Rory clearing all the shit out of the place. It stunk. The cats used to sleep in there. The dogs, it was full of whatever, I don't know. You didn't have skips in them days to get shut in it either, you know. But I remember that, and it was a drive from then onwards, you see. She had this drive.
I just don't know what's going to replace her.
Taking her inspiration for the name from the Charles Boyer film Algiers, preparations began in earnest for the opening night of the Casbah on August the 29th, 1959. As Bill Harry, the editor of Merseybeat, points out, this was significant not just in the context of live music in Liverpool, but in the history of popular culture.
Obviously, it was the first regular cellar club to provide rock and roll in Liverpool. The Cavern didn't. The Cavern certainly, even for years after the Casbah opened, it was still banning the local groups and concentrating on the jazz bands. It was Very, very significant, because basically, if one considers the facts, it was the Casbah that was the birthplace of the Beatles. If I said to somebody, you think of a club in Liverpool beginning with C, of so many letters, which was the birthplace of the Beatles, everyone would say the Cavern. But the Casbah has the same number of letters, and I always pose this to people, because to me, that was the birthplace of the Beatles, because the Beatles wouldn't have existed but for the Casbah Club itself. The Quarrymen had ceased to perform. They were no longer a group. John and Paul got together to write songs in Fourth Lynn Road. They had visions of becoming songwriters and writing songs for people like Frank Sinatra. So they were writing songs, and there was no group. They didn't perform. And since there was no one, they weren't performing any longer. They more or less disbanded. George had joined another group called the Les Stewart Quartet, and they performed in Heywood's Green at a place called Lowlands. And a girlfriend of George's, Ruth Morrison, told George, and I think it was Ken Brown as well, who was in the Les Stewart Quartet with him, about the new club that's going to open, and they could have a chance of playing there regularly. And they were offered the residency. But when they went to see Les Stewart, he refused. I'm not going to play there, you know. So George said to Ken Brown, well, I've got two mates, we could form a group. And he went and got John and Paul, and they reformed the Quarrymen again to take up this residency at the Casbah. And therefore, that led to the creation of the Beatles. If that hadn't happened, you know, George would have still been in the Les Stewart Quartet, and those two wouldn't be performing, they would have been writing songs.
Quarrymen, featuring a lineup of John, Paul, George and Ken Brown, provided the soundtrack for the Casbah Club's first crowd. Paul, John and John's then-girlfriend Cynthia Powell also contributed to the decor of the club in the days before its opening. Cynthia's silhouette sketch of John and a star pattern daubed on by John and Paul still line the walls of the club today. John's severe short-sightedness also led to parts of the club being painted in gloss rather than matte paint. Initially, the club operated on a pay-on-the-door policy, but the swelling numbers soon prompted a move to a membership system with blue cards for boys and pink for girls. It was unlicensed, though Liverpool's first Gagier espresso machine fueled the club members with coffee, Coca-Cola, orange juice, soup and buns also being available on the menu. More than 50 years on, Bernie Grindley has clear memories of the early nights at the Casbah and its raw energy.
It was obviously heaving in a mass of sweat, but when you're young and there's people from 13 up to, say, 19 in there, you don't mind that uncomfortable, but that doesn't matter. And it was brilliant. And of course, you know, I don't know how many different groups played there. I probably saw, at the top of my head, about 15 to 20 different groups that had played there, you know. To be part of that as a young person was just... It didn't make any difference whether they were good, bad or indifferent, to be honest with you, because you were just part of something on your doorstep that was special. And the reason I say special, you know, that's not through biasness, because obviously we started to see the Beatles in various other venues, you know, throughout. But there was nowhere like the Casbah, where you could literally stand next to John Lennon You know, his guitar could hit you, sort of thing, as he was playing.
The Beatles, as they evolved out of the Quarrymen, went on to give 40 performances in the Casbah Club. What distinguished the Casbah was its position as Liverpool's first exclusively rock and roll club. The majority of the city's night spots in the late 1950s having begun life as jazz, country or folk venues. Bill Harry.
Liverpool was called the Nashville of the North because it had the biggest country music scene in Europe. Liverpool groups went over to appear on the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. And a number of Liverpool musicians still live in Nashville. And in Liverpool, they had the Grand Ole Opry at the Philharmonic Hall. They had a country music association. Then you had the black music scene around the Upper Parliament Street area with the doo-wop and everything. You had groups like The Chants and Sugar Dean and people like that. So you had a good, strong black music scene with great singers like Steve Aldo. Then you had the folk music scene with the Spinners, who were the biggest folk group in Britain for a quarter of a century. Then you had the Mersey Poets, who became Britain's biggest poets. So we had the country's top poets, the country's top country groups, the country's top folk group, you know, all that. And it seems to have vanished in the haze just because of the Beatles. There was a lot more to Liverpool and the music and the scene in those days than just the Beatles.
It was also unique in being owned and run by a woman.
You must remember the attitude in Liverpool was one of those where women were almost second class. You know, the men went out to booze up and have their drinks and everything, and the wife had to stay in the kitchen making the dinner and ironing the clothes and doing the shopping and all this business, you know. So people did object to women being stronger in places, you know. And so that was why there was only a handful of sort of women in the scene itself. Now, she was an independent woman who wanted to get things done. Strangely enough, some people seem to resent this, which seems crazy to me, but that was the way things were at the time. Attitudes have changed since then.
Saxophonist Howie Casey of Derry and the Seniors highlights the warm and, more importantly, safe atmosphere that Mona created at the Casbah, in marked contrast to some other Merseyside venues.
It was funky. It was little and funky, you know, very close up and personal when you played there, you know. The sweat and condensation running down the walls, you know. It was well-liked, I know that. All the bands, you know, they liked playing there. There was... You know, he didn't have the finger of like, oh God, we're going to go and play the Casbah. No, he liked playing there, you know. Some of the others, you'd find there was an atmosphere of violence, you know, some, you know, because a lot, you had that thing where, you know, the girls would be in the middle of the dance floor, dancing around the handbags, you know, and all the blokes would be standing looking surly either side, you know. And then there was bouncers, especially, I remember the Hollyoak and Blair Hall, these bouncers, heavy duty, and they had like sort of truncheon things, and they just walk round and round and round the dance floor, you know. And of course, the blokes, they'd get fired up. They didn't drink in there, but they'd, you know, they'd bring stuff in, or they'd get well tanked before they came in, and it would kick off, you know, you knew it. And of course the girls got, and then the bundle started, you know.
Bundles just weren't a feature of Nights at the Casbah, largely because of Mona's presence and the respect she commanded. Bernie Grinley.
There was very few off-licences in those days, but pubs had the off-licences attached to them, the little room. And it was me and my twin brother, and another guy. We used to buy a quarter of a bottle of whiskey. Not every night, but often we'd buy a quarter of a bottle of whiskey and drink it neat and go in. But of course you knew Mrs. Best's view on things like that. She was a liberal woman, but she didn't want any rowdiness or drunkenness. You know, she had a line, and you enjoy yourself, be a little bit mad, but don't go over that line. And if you do, I'll tell you. You know, that was her. Everybody knew it.
As Bill Harry is at pains to note, the scene on Merseyside was much larger than just the Beatles. Both skiffle and the early rock and roll boom had produced a mass of groups, and as Howie Casey recalls, an important link with another European port city was being established.
We were offered auditions by Alan Williams for Larry Parnes. He said, I've got Larry Parnes coming down, he's bringing Billy Fiore, and they want bands to back their artists. They were doing, summer season in Blackpool or somewhere like that. And, you know, cheap old bands from Liverpool, you know. We were saying, well, we'll have some of that, you know, great. So we all did our auditions, you know. We did that, and then we got the sort of news, yep. It's all on. Yeah, you've all. And I don't know, it was Duffy Powell or Dickie Pride, we got the gig to back, you know. They were more in what we were doing, the style we were doing, you know. And so that was great. And some of us had jobs at that time, so packed in the jobs, you know. That was a good excuse, wasn't it, you know, packing the job. The news came through not long afterwards that it fell through, the whole thing. Going, oh, shit, you know, what the hell are we going to do now? So I went down to see Alan, and he said, what we'll do is we'll drive down to London and we'll go to Larry Parnes' office and see what he can organise for you. So, you know, naive. And so we piled in, a couple of days later, into a couple of cars, took our instruments and everything with us. On the way down, it was said that, now we can't get to see Larry Parnes, but we'll go to the Two Eyes Coffee Bar. And if you're playing there, that might be good, you know. So again, naive, you know, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And we got to the Two Eyes. The boss was a guy, I think his name was Tom Littlewood. And there was an upstairs, like a sort of coffee bar, caf type thing, and downstairs where the bands played, you know. And Alan went in to see if they'd let us play. no sign of money. And he said, yeah, okay, you know, I'll give the boys a piece of cake. And so we went downstairs, and there was obviously full of musicians, there was a band on playing, and so when they came off, we went on, started playing, and in the audience was this guy from Germany, Bruno Koschmider, from Hamburg, and he owned the Kaiser Keller. We didn't know this at the time, but what had happened was there was a band called the Jets had been playing the Kaiser Keller. That was Tony Sheridan's band, you know. And they moved to a new club called the Top Ten on the Reeperbahn. The Kaiser Keller was on the Grosser Freiheit. So he looked at our band, and it was almost a mirror image of what Tony Sheridan had, because Tony had a black singer and a saxophone player, and so did we, you know. So he's, oh, that'll do, you know. So he got together with Alan, and they signed a contract, you know. And we got the gig, and that was the Kaiser Keller at £15 a week per man. You sleep in the club,
and you buy your own food and drink. We loved it, you know, it was great. There were chicks, there was booze, there was, you know, it was nothing like Liverpool, you know, because Liverpool, there's a curfew on booze at, say, 10, 10.30, maybe 11, I don't know, you know, but any of the clubs that, you know, I remember that once in Liverpool, we were playing in a club, and the cops just burst in, and it was probably only about 11 o'clock at night, and they didn't have a license there, and, you know, got a full pint on the table, next thing, stop drinking. And they put sort of cellophane with elastic bands around all the drinks, you know, to the evidence, you know. And so that showed you the attitude, really, was, you know, it was pretty tight on booze and stuff in Britain, I think, generally at that time.
Thank you.
For Mike Pender of The Searchers, Hamburg and Liverpool had something of a shared character.
Similar in style to Liverpool, I found. And probably the people there probably had a similar lifestyle. Going to pubs, singing songs. The only thing that was different, they didn't have groups like Merseyside. They wanted the groups. And that was probably why somebody like Manfred Weissleder got the idea. And because he had the money, he thought, yeah, the Grossing Freiheit. There are so many people who come to that area. I will open a club. And he thought, if I bring in big American stars like Jerry Lee, like Ray Charles, Fats Domino, Brenda Lee, for just a week and put them on every night and then fill in the whole night with other type music people, a la Over to Liverpool, Beatles, Searchers, Jerry and the Pacemakers, probably about a dozen other groups. We were the workhorses in the Star Club and they'd have the big star there. And that whole generation in Germany of young people, they just loved us. We made so many friends with young people, you know, young lads whose fathers were in the war, or relations were in the war, that was all forgotten. They wanted to be friends again. And that generation and our generation, we just made it up to each other.
By the time the Beatles had joined Derry and the Seniors in Hamburg, I had joined the group. And the rest, as they say, is history, and partly my story. Returning to Liverpool for our first comeback date at the Casbah on the 17th of December 1960, our equipment remained in Hamburg. Club member Georgie Spruce, aka El Preston, has reason to remember the night very well.
I was a member, I think I was about 17 or 18. And I made some friends within the club. The particular blokes I'm talking about, Tony Waddington in particular, fantastic guitarist, he just said to me, can you sing? And I said, well, no, I've never thought of singing. He said, well, you should really. He said, you've got the looks of the day, you know what I mean? I'm not talking about now, I'm talking about that time. Anyway, we formed this little group and we used to rehearse in his house. And Mrs. Best found out that we had this little group, so she said, would you play on here? So we said, okay. I think we played there twice. And on the third occasion, she came downstairs and she said, my son's in a group. She didn't say where they'd been. She said, they're home from abroad and they've got no equipment. Can they use yours. Well, when you say equipment, we had not a full kit of drums, maybe a snare and a hi-hat and a bass drum and one 15-watt amplifier. No PA. That was the way it was in them days. So the mic, a little Acoss mic, which cost about 30 shillings, I think, £1.50 in today's money. I used that, and the guitarist and the, I think it was the bass player, went into this little amp. I mean, it was that bad. But one of us had to either sit on it or keep our foot on it to stop it from jumping around. Because when you look at the speaker, it was like the old speakers from the old radiograms. You know what I mean? 15 watt. Anyway, we said, yeah, no problem. And because you couldn't buy drink in, because it was like a youth club, so we went across the road to the pub that we drank in, and we had a bit of a following. These girls followed us over, and they said, "You've got to see this group. They're very unusual." I said, "In what way?" She said, "Well, they're doing funny songs, and they don't look like the standard group then, because we all had quiffs and whatever." And anyway, we went over. As soon as we heard them, I went, oh, Paul was singing "Oh My Soul." And then John sang, I forget the song what he sang. And then George sang. And I said, I've never heard anything like this. Because in them days, it was just the main singer. You know, that was the way it was. And we knew from then, from the very first time I saw them, I thought, these are a special group. And I'll still say it today, I preferred the old Beatles, although their songwriting is fantastic. They wrote some of their best songs, pop songs of all time. But as a basic beat group, the early Beatles were fantastic. I've never heard a group like them.
The Casbah continued to grow, and it effectively functioned as a private members club with a membership somewhere in the region of 2,000, far exceeding its capacity of 250, or thereabouts. In an era before health and safety regulations, more than 1,000 people came to this tiny venue in a single night, though some didn't make it beyond the grounds where you could soak up some of the atmosphere and sounds emanating from below. My brother Rogue describes some of the issues arising from the club's expansion.
Because the Casbah got larger and larger, you know, they were taking walls down and opening rooms up and breaking walls through to get into other rooms. And then their final expansion, they were starting to take a wall down, they'd worked out, they took a wall down, they'd create another room that would also run into the coal cellar, which would then expand the club again. And they'd started taking the wall down, and there was a club member who came, and they're saying, "Hey, look, we've got to do this to expand the club. We're smashing this wall." And he said, "I really wouldn't do that if I was you fellas. That's the actual foundations of your house." And they'd already started smashing it down. The hall's still there.
The Casbah's role in the story of the Beatles has, without question, been neglected. It was here, for example, on the 10th of December 1961, that the group signed their contract with Brian Epstein, and as Bill Harry notes, it was Mona's nous and drive that was crucial to their early development.
She did more for them on the management side over the particular crucial period than Alan Williams did. She was the one who, when the Beatles came back from Germany, really managed the group. You know, got everything sorted out, got Neil to help them, got Pete to do with the bookings and make the arrangements when they're going to be picked up by Neil and all the rest of that. She was the one who got on to Bob Woller and everything and Ray McFall about getting them the gig at the Cavern. She was the one who wrote to BBC Radio to get them on the radio. And the letters still exist. You know, she was doing all this. And yet everybody calls Alan Williams their first manager.
The Beatles' Sunday night residency at the Casbah predated their success at the Cavern, and those who saw us play here share the sensation that there was something very special about those early gigs. A common feeling among all the bands who played at the Casbah was its unique intimacy.
Yeah. everybody knew each other. Like the crowd, you'd see them in the Orla Park ballroom, you'd see them in the cafe.
Jeff Nugent of The Undertakers.
So you got to know the crowd. You got to know faces. You might not know all the names, but you got to know faces. And you could enjoy the show, you know, and things like that. And you could rapport with them. Unlike some of the big places where you were sort of felt like you're a million miles away from the audience. That compact, you wondered who was playing, whether it was the audience or you.
Stage equipment was basic, to say the least. But who's to say that didn't add to the atmosphere? Earl Preston and Howie Casey.
When I think of the sound systems we had, it must have been so bad because the PAs were just like a 12-inch speaker open-backed. There was no top end, there was no horns or something. And it was so muddy. But don't forget, it was very early days and people were just made up, like people were leaving school at the time, to be able to go out and dance to a group. It was just, it was a fabulous time, you know.
Stage manners, often that's only a recent thing, isn't it? Really, comparatively. In fact, when we first started out, we put the mics and everything through the amps, you know. So, you know, there'd be one amp, you know, and there'd be a mic in it, and then the, you know, for the vocals, and then the guitars would come through it, and maybe a bit for the sax, but most of the time I was playing acoustic. Or if the solo came up, you know, Derry or Freddie would poke the mic towards me and I'd play a solo like that, you know. So, and PAs, I mean, geez, you know, that was... I think the Remo Ford, I think they were one of the first bands to have their own PA. They had all this gear, you know, good quality gear. And I think they called themselves a £1,000 Remo Ford, because that's what it costs for all the gear, you know.
Bill Harry agrees that there was an indefinable quality to the early days of Merseybeat.
It was fantastic. I mean, when I used to listen to the Beatles and the other groups, the hair used to stand out the back of my neck. It went through you. It was the excitement. There's something about it that I don't think can be equal today. When you think you're in a small place, the band is there, the music is loud, it's all over you. It's more than three or four dimensional. Now I look at some of these concerts and I see somebody who's about an eighth of an inch in the distance and 70,000 people watching them, and I think, I could never stand in a crowd like that about half a mile from the artist, you know what I mean? I've been to every type of venue from, I used to go to all the Isle of Wight festivals, the Reading festivals, all those, the American festivals, but, you know, you can't beat the origin. When you think this was the beginning, this was the beginning of a musical revolution. When you were there, you were part of it. And it wasn't just the musicians, you were involved as well. It was a community, all the fans, the people who watch and everything like that. They all have the memories and the time, and it's something that can't be repeated.
A combination of factors, including my grandmother's death and the fact that Mona was heavily pregnant with Rogue, led to her deciding to close the Casbah in the early summer of 1962, the Beatles giving the final performance there on the 24th of June. In later years, Rogue recalls Mona describing it as an emotional year.
In the May of 62, she lost her mother. In the June of 62, she closed the Casbah. In the July of 62, I was born. In the August of 62, Pete was dismissed from the band. So she said that period of time, emotionally, she didn't know whether she was coming or going. Everything was just bang, 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 piling on top of each other. All these different emotions, you know, emotions of loss, then, hey, let's be happy, another lot, let's be happy. So she said she didn't know whether she was coming or going for a period of time there.
The Casbah had closed and my association with the Beatles had ended, but they, of course, continued on their path.
We were all together, And at that particular time, I wrote a song. It was the first song I ever wrote, one called Sweet Love. It wasn't anything special, it was just a song.
Earl Preston, by now fronting the TTs, remembers sharing an early bill with them.
And I came off, and the Beatles were in the band room waiting to go on. And Paul said to me, he used to call me Wee George, because George Harrison was the tallest in the group. So when George was there, and I was there, I'd be Wee George. He said, Wee George, I like that. And I said, I'm surprised you haven't written any songs. He said, because you're a fantastic group. And these words will never leave me. He said, we've written a few, but they're not really all that good.
Paul's view may have been that the early songs weren't all that good, but the success of Love Me Do led to a rush to sign up Merseybeat groups. Suddenly it seemed that Liverpool was awash with A&R men waving checkbooks. In fact, Derry and the Seniors were the first to be signed ahead of the Beatles, and they were followed in short succession by the likes of Farron's Flamingos, The Searchers, Kingsize Taylor and the Dominoes, Jerry and the Pacemakers, the Remo Four, El Preston and the TTs, the Swingin' Blue Jeans, and Lee Curtis and the All Stars, who I'd by this stage joined.
Holy got a rocking band. Come on, baby, hold my hand, let's stomp. Yeah, baby, let's stomp now. See you looking fine, I wanna make you mine, let's stomp. Hey, baby, put the stompers on. Do the dance, it's really gone, let's stomp. Yeah, baby, let's stomp now. You know you're looking good like I knew you would, let's stomp.
Merseyside's dominance of the UK charts was such that from April 1963 to May 1964, a Merseybeat record was at number one for 51 out of 60 weeks.
Hey baby, it's me and you. Gonna stomp the whole night through, let's stomp.
2 hours of the remaining weeks being topped by Peter and Gordon's World Without Love, written by Paul McCartney. It was a phenomenon that was unprecedented and unmatched, as music journalist Paul Dunoyer observes.
The curious thing about Merseybeat is that apart from the Beatles and I guess Cilla Black, who both went on to lasting fame, most of the people who were the leading lights of the Merseybeat movement sort of fell by the wayside in the mid-60s. And the whole of pop music changed in nature in the middle-60s under the influence of people like Bob Dylan and the more advanced psychedelic rock acts. And most Merseybeat just began to seem obsolete, really. The Beatles themselves helped to make Merseybeat obsolete, obviously because of the great innovations that they brought about. But Merseybeat went from being, you know, the happening thing to something slightly embarrassing almost overnight. One of the problems with Merseybeat was that it seems it was much better as a live phenomenon than it was in the records that attempted to capture it, because studio recordings were fairly primitive in those days. The Beatles, as usual, did better than most because they had George Martin and a good team at EMI. Most of the contemporaries weren't quite that lucky, and people who were around at the time and saw these bands playing in places like the Cavern will always say, oh, you know, the records weren't a patch on how great and how tough sounding those groups were in the flesh. So I guess Merseybeat never really left an enduring monument to itself. The totality of Merseybeat's success was so instant that its demise was likely to be fairly quick as well.
It's arguable that very few of the records that the Merseybeat acts released got anywhere near capturing the live essence of their stage act. Howie Casey.
People don't react the same in the studio as they do live. The adrenaline's different. They can be nervousness, they can hold themselves back in the studio, you know. Not consciously maybe, but you do, you know. You'll do great solos on stage, right? But then you go in the studio to do that number, and I don't say you play the same solo, but you can't get that feeling, the nuance in your playing maybe, you know. Sometimes I've achieved good solos, which I like, and on record, but I know there's been far better ones live, you know. Because you're only free, you're letting yourself go, you're expressing yourself totally, you know. And I suppose that's what it is, isn't it, in the end. You know, it's a bit cold and clinical, a studio. You know, you walk in these super studios, and it is a thing, it's like, it's not got that, the feeling of a live gig. And even trying to record live, they're never quite catch it, I don't think. It's very difficult.
Prior to the Beatles making it, I mean, nobody ever thought that a northern group, Liverpool, Manchester, whatever, would ever make records, because although Billy Fiore, like, but he, I think, we associated him with like a solo singer. But as groups, it was only the Shadows and, you know, people like that. We were more raucous, raw. So I don't think anybody ever thought a northern group would ever be successful. And then it was Fontana. They saw us and asked us to go down to London. And this is how naive we were. I don't know whether I had the gold army jacket still or whatever. And we went down just to do a rehearsal so they could hear us. And we went down and we had all our stage gear on. That's how naive we were. They just said, just do whatever you do on stage, and if any songs you've written, do them as well. So we just went through them all. And I think we'd done about 12 songs altogether. And Fontana at that time didn't have the ability, I don't think a lot of them did, to record groups. There was no bass, or the bass was very subdued, and because they'd been used to like orchestras and stuff like that. And some of the recordings were very bad.
That everyone on the scene was in agreement about was the Big Three, who were generally regarded as one of the most powerful and popular live acts. Their recording career amounted to just 4 singles and 1 EP, yet those who saw them feel that their potential was never fully realised. Bernie Grindley.
I'd say, for instance, you had a poll of the Liverpool groups, what they used to in the Merseybeat, but you only had a guys-only poll. The Big Three would have won it.
They probably, if they'd have agreed to have got along with Epstein, could certainly have been as big as the Searchers. They were special.
Hi there, all you cave dwellers. This is Bob Willis saying welcome to the Best of Sellers. We've got the hi-fi high and the lights down low, so here we go with the Big Three show.
They blew the place apart, you know. But again, they weren't looking at being commercial. They were straight ahead sort of R&B, I guess, you know. And they wanted to coach them into being nice boys and to start singing nice songs, poppy songs. And they didn't want to do it. And if they did anything, then their hearts weren't in it, you know. So that's probably one of the reasons, you know. They wanted them to like, dress up nicely. And because they were, you know, it was raw edge stuff, you know, real power stuff.
Merseybeat's decline was as rapid as its rise had been, and it remains an unjustly ignored period in British music that is ripe for re-evaluation. Back in West Derby Village, the basement that once housed Merseyside's first rock and roll club had once more returned to being a storage space. In 1988, I was at a Beatles convention in Liverpool, where Mona, unbeknownst to the rest of the family, made an announcement that the Casbah Club was to reopen. Once again, the family was involved in an extensive clearing out operation. Rogue best.
Clearing it out turned out to be a wonderful thing, because there was this trove of treasures that people had forgotten that were down there, you know, boxes full of Beatle posters and, you know, original Beatle posters, and boxes full of microphones. And then there was a whole back line of the Beatles, basically, that was wedged behind a mirror and stacked up in the corner. But you couldn't get to the corner because you couldn't get to the room, because she wouldn't throw anything out, you see. She was a hoarder. She kept everything.
The club opened for a one-off weekend in August 1988. And Mona sadly passed away just a few weeks later on September the 9th. In 2009, the club reopened as a live music venue, and one night a month they host Rock the Casbah, showcasing local bands. It's also becoming something of a tourist attraction for those on the Beatles trail.
For goodness sake!
The Beatle fans that come absolutely love it. You do physically see their jaws dropping because they never realised the impact the Casbah had on the Beatles. So many people come to the Casbah that walk out at the end of it going, "Oh my God, I had no idea."
The hippie, hippie say,
In 2006, the then Culture Secretary David Lammy announced that the Casbah Club was to be given Grade 2 listed status and a blue plaque following a petition by the West Derby Village Historical Society and English Heritage. Paul McCartney acknowledges its importance and the fact that it was and remains a special place.
That's a nice place because people forget that. They talk about the Cavern, but actually we played there before we played the Cavern, so it's quite, in Beatles history, it's quite a special place.
Its standing today is a lasting tribute to Mona, whose vision in opening a basement club in 1959 and then leaving it untouched allows visitors to see a permanent historical record of where the Beatles story really began.
The Cavern, the original Cavern, no longer existed. A replica had been built in its place. Aintree Institute was knocked down. The David Lewis Theatre, where they did a particular appearance for the fan club, had gone. Almost every venue in Liverpool where the Beatles appeared, they'd either been demolished, like the Iron Door Club and the Mardi Gras, all those clubs had gone. And or being taken over by something else. I mean, Litherland Town Hall is now a medical centre and they will not allow a plaque on the wall saying the Beatles had appeared there. But when the Casbah reopened again, it was exactly the same with no change as it had been the last time the Beatles appeared there. So it is the only club in Liverpool which is exactly the same as when the Beatles used to make appearances there. No other club can claim that.
Said, "Move on."
I'm Pete Best, and you've been listening to the Casbah Club, the birthplace of Merseybeat, a BBC Six music production for Radio 2, written and produced by Henry Lopez Real.